As he headed toward the one-minute manager's office, he kept thinking about the simplicity of one-minute management. All three of the secrets made sense. One-minute goals, one-minute praisings, and one-minute reprimands. But why do they work? Why is the one-minute manager the most productive manager in the company? As the young man entered the office, he noticed again how clear and uncluttered it was. He was greeted by a warm smile from the one-minute manager. Tell me what you learned in your travels. I found out why you call yourself a one-minute manager. You set one-minute goals with your people to make sure that they know what they're being held accountable for and what good performance looks like. You then try to catch them doing something right so you can give them a one-minute praising. And then finally, if they have all the skills to do something right and they don't, you give them a one-minute reprimand. Well, what do you think about all that? I'm amazed at how simple it is. But when you talk about one-minute management, do you really mean it takes a minute to do all the kinds of things you need to do as a manager? No, not always. It just is a way to say that being a manager is not as complicated as people would have you believe. So when I say one-minute management, it might take more than a minute for each of the key elements like goal setting, but it's just a symbolic term. And very often, it does take only a minute. Let me show you one of the notes I keep on my desk. The best minute I spend is the one I invest in people. It's ironic. Most companies spend 50% to 70% of their money on people's salaries, and yet they spend less than 1% of their budget to train their people. Most companies, in fact, spend more time and money on maintaining their buildings and equipment than they do on maintaining and developing people. That's interesting, but I'm not sure I understand it. In fact, if it's all right with you, maybe I could understand things better if I could get to some of my why questions. Let's start with one-minute goal setting. Why does it work so well? Well, let me give you an analogy that might help. One night I was bowling and I saw some problem employees at work from my last organization. One of the real problem people, who I remember all too well, took the bowling ball and approached the line and rolled the ball. Then he started to scream and yell and jump around. Why do you think he was so happy? Because he got a strike. He had knocked down all the pins. Exactly. Why don't you think he and other people are that excited at work? Because he doesn't know where the pins are? Right. I believe that most managers know what they want their people to do. They just don't bother to tell their people in a way they would understand. They assume they should know. I never assume anything when it comes to goal setting. When you assume that people know what's expected of them, you're creating an ineffective form of bowling. You put the pins up, but when the bowler goes to roll the ball, he notices that there's a sheet across the pins. So when he rolls the ball and it slips under the sheet, he hears a crack, but doesn't know how many pins he knocked down. When you ask how he did, he says, "I don't know, but it felt good." It's all because clearly the number one motivator of people is feedback on results. In fact, we have another saying here that's worth noting. Feedback is the breakfast of champions. Feedback keeps us going. Unfortunately, however, when most managers realize that feedback on results is the number one motivator of people, they usually set up a third form of bowling. When the bowler goes to the line to roll the ball, the pins are still up and the sheet is in place, but now there's another ingredient in the game, a supervisor standing behind the sheet. When the bowler rolls the ball, he hears the crash of the falling pins, and the supervisor holds up two fingers to signify you knocked down two pins. Actually, they usually say you missed eight. The question I always used to ask was, why doesn't the manager lift the sheet up so both he and his subordinate can see the pins? Why? Because he has the great American tradition, performance review, coming up. I used to call that NIHYSOB, which stands for Now I Have You, You SOB. Such managers don't tell their people what they expect of them. They just leave them alone and then zap them when they don't perform at the desired level. Why do you suppose they would do that? The young man inquired, being very familiar with the truth in the manager's comments. So they can look good? How do you think you would be viewed by your boss if you rated everyone that reported to you at the highest level on your performance review scale? As a soft touch. As someone who could not discriminate between good performance and poor performance. Precisely. In order to look good as a manager in most organizations, you have to catch some of your people doing things wrong. You have to have a few winners, a few losers, and everyone else somewhere in the middle. I remember once reading that when someone asked Einstein what his phone number was, he went to the phone book to look it up. He said he never cluttered his mind with information he could find elsewhere. Now, if you didn't know better, what would you think of someone who went to the phone book to look up his own number? Would you think he was a winner or a loser? A real loser. I would, too. But we'd be wrong, wouldn't we? It's easy for any of us to make this mistake. Look at this plaque. Everyone is a potential winner. Some people are disguised as losers. Don't let their appearances fool you. You see, you really have three choices as a manager. First, you can hire winners. They're hard to find and they cost money. Or second, if you can't find a winner, you can hire someone with the potential to be a winner. Then you systematically train that person to become a winner. If you're not willing to do either of the first two, then there's only the third choice left. Prayer. That stopped the young man cold. He put down his notebook and pen. Prayer? That's just my attempt at humor, young man. Well, let's take the first choice. If you hire a winner, it's really easy to be a one-minute manager, isn't it? Sure is. He was amazed at how serious the young man was now, as though being more serious made a person a better manager. All you have to do with a winner is do one-minute goal setting and let them run with the ball. Is it true that each goal always has to be written down on a single sheet of paper? Absolutely. Well, why is that so important? So people can review their goals frequently and then check their performance against those goals. I understand you have them write down only their major goals and responsibilities, not every aspect of the job. Yes, that's because I don't want this to be a paper mill. I don't want a lot of pieces of paper filed away somewhere and looked at only once a year when it's time for next year's goal setting or performance review or some such thing. As you probably saw, everyone who works for me has a plaque near them that looks like this. Take a minute, look at your goals, look at your performance, see if your behavior matches your goals. It's terrific. Could I get one of these plaques? Sure, I'll arrange it. Thanks. Could we move on to the one-minute praising now? Asked the young man as he looked up from his notebook. Sure. You're probably wondering why that works, too. I certainly am. Let's look at a few examples. Maybe then it will be clear to you why one-minute praising works so well. I'd like that. I'll start with a whale example, and then move on to people. Just remember, young man, people are not whales. People are more complicated. They are aware, they think for themselves, and they certainly don't want to be manipulated by another person. Remember that and respect that. It's a key to good management. Now, at some of the sea aquariums you see around the country, they usually end the show by having a huge whale jump over a rope which is high above the water. When the whale comes down, he drenches the first 10 rows. The people leave that show mumbling to themselves, "That's unbelievable. How do they teach that whale to do that?" Do you think they go out in the ocean in a boat and put a rope out over the water and yell, "Up, up," until a whale jumps out of the water over the rope and then say, "Hey, let's hire him. He's a real winner." No, but that really would be hiring a winner. The two men enjoyed the laugh they shared. You're right. When they captured the whale, he knew nothing about jumping over ropes. So when they began to train him in the large pool, where do you think they started the rope? At the bottom of the pool. Of course. Every time the whale swam over the rope, which was every time he swam past, he got fed. Soon they raised the rope a little. If the whale swam under the rope, he didn't get fed during training. Whenever he swam over the rope, he got fed. So after a while, the whale started swimming over the rope all the time. Then they started raising the rope a little higher. Over a period of time, they keep on raising the rope until they finally get it to the surface of the water. Now the great whale knows that in order to get fed, he has to jump partially out of the water and over the rope. As soon as that goal is reached, they can start raising the rope higher and higher out of the water. The young man was amazed. So that's how they do it. Well, I can understand now how using that method works with animals, but isn't it a bit much to use with people? No, it's very natural, in fact. We all do essentially the same thing with the children we care for. How do you think you teach them to walk? Can you imagine standing a child up and saying, "Walk," and when he falls down, you pick him up and spank him and say, "I told you to walk"? No, you stand the child up, and the first day, he wobbles a little bit. And you get all excited and say, he stood, and you hug and kiss the child. The next day, he stands for a moment, and maybe he wobbles a step, and you're all over him with kisses and hugs. Finally, the child, realizing that this is a pretty good deal, starts to wobble his legs more and more until he eventually walks. These examples illustrate that the most important thing in training somebody to become a winner is to catch them doing something right. In the beginning, approximately right, and gradually moving them towards the desired behavior. With a winner, you don't have to catch them doing things right very often, because good performers catch themselves doing things right and are able to be self-reinforcing. Is that why you observe new people a lot in the beginning? Or when your more experienced people are starting new projects? Yes. Most managers wait until their people do something exactly right before they praise them. As a result, many people never get to become high performers because their managers concentrate on catching them doing things wrong. That is, anything that falls short of the final desired performance. After getting punished for a while and not knowing what acceptable behavior is, they don't move. It's a hostile environment and not worth taking any risks in. That is what we often do with new, inexperienced people. We welcome them aboard, take them around to meet everybody, and then we leave them alone. Not only do we not catch them doing anything approximately right, but periodically we zap them just to keep them moving. This is the most popular leadership style of all. We call it the leave-alone zap style. You leave a person alone, expecting good performance from them, and when you don't get it, you zap them. After a while, these people do as little as possible. And that's what's wrong with most businesses today. Their people really do not produce, either quantity or quality. And much of the reason for this poor business performance is simply because the people are managed so poorly. If inexperienced people don't perform, that is, do what you want them to do, then rather than punish them, we need to go back to one-minute goal setting and make sure they understand what is expected of them and that they have seen what good performance looks like. Well then, after you've done one-minute goal setting again, do you try to catch them doing something approximately right again? Precisely so. You're always trying to create situations in the beginning where you can give a one-minute praising. The manager looked the man straight in the eye. You're a very enthusiastic and receptive learner. And that makes me feel good about sharing the secrets of one-minute management with you. They both smiled. They knew a one-minute praising when they heard one. I sure enjoy a praising more than a reprimand. I think I understand now why one-minute goals and one-minute praisings work. They really do make sense to me. Good, said the one-minute manager. But I can't imagine why the one-minute reprimand works. Let me tell you a few things about it. To begin with, the feedback in the one-minute reprimand is immediate. That is, you get to the individual as soon as you observe the misbehavior, or your data information system tips you off. It's not appropriate to gunny sack or save up negative feelings about someone's poor performance. The fact that the feedback is so immediate is an important lesson in why the one-minute reprimand works so well. Unless discipline occurs as close to the misbehavior as possible, it tends not to be as helpful in influencing future behavior. Most managers are gunny sack discipliners. That is, they store up observations of poor behavior. And then, someday, when performance review comes, or they're angry in general because the sack is so full, they charge in and dump everything on the table. They tell people all the things they've done wrong for the last few weeks, or months, or more. If managers would try to intervene early, they could deal with one behavior at a time, and the person receiving the discipline would not be overwhelmed. They could hear the feedback. That's why I think performance review is an ongoing process, not something you do only once a year. And secondly, when I give a one-minute reprimand, I never attack a person's worth or value as a person. Since their okayness as a person is not up for grabs, they don't feel they have to defend themselves. I reprimand the behavior only. Thus, my feedback and their own reactions to it is about the specific behavior and not their feelings about themselves as human beings. So often when disciplining people, managers persecute the individual. My purpose in a one-minute reprimand is to eliminate the behavior and keep the person. So that's why you make the second half of the reprimand appraising. Their behavior is not okay, but they are okay. Yes. Well, why wouldn't you give the praising first and then the reprimand? For some reason, it just doesn't work. Some people, now that I think of it, say that I'm a nice and tough manager, but to be more accurate, I'm really tough and nice. I do know this. If you are first tough on the behavior and then supportive of the person, it works. Do you have any modern-day examples of where the one-minute reprimand has worked other than in management? Certainly. Let me mention two. One with severe adult behavior problems and another in disciplining children. What do you mean when you say severe adult behavior problems? I'm talking about alcoholics in particular. About 30 years ago, an observant clergyman discovered a technique which is now called crisis intervention. He made the discovery when he was helping a physician's wife. She was in a Minnesota hospital in critical condition and slowly dying from cirrhosis of the liver. But she was still denying that she had a drinking problem. When all her family had gathered at her bedside, the clergyman asked each of them to describe specific drinking incidents they had observed. That's an important part of the one-minute reprimand. Before giving a reprimand, you have to see the behavior yourself. You can't depend on what someone else saw. You never give a reprimand based on hearsay. After the family described specific behaviors, the clergyman asked each of the family members to tell the woman how they felt about those incidents. Gathered closely around her, one by one, they told her first what she did, and second, how they felt about it. They were angry, frustrated, embarrassed. And then they told her how much they loved her. And they instinctively touched her and gently said how they wanted her to live and to enjoy life once again. That was why they were so angry with her. It sounds so simple, especially with something as complicated as a drinking problem. Did it work? Amazingly so. And now there are crisis intervention centers all over the country. It's not as simple as I've summarized it, of course. But these three basic ingredients, telling people what they did wrong, telling people how you feel about it, and reminding people that they are valuable and worthwhile, lead to significant improvements in people's behavior. That's nothing short of incredible. You said you'd give me two examples of how other people successfully use methods like the one-minute reprimand. Yes, of course. In the early 1970s, a family psychiatrist in California also made the same amazing discovery with children. He'd read a lot about bonding, the emotional ties people have to people. People need to be in contact with people who care about them, to be accepted as valuable just because they are people. The doctor also knew that people need to have a spade called a spade, to be pulled up short by people who care when they are not behaving well. Each parent is taught to physically touch the child by putting their hand on the child's shoulder, touching his arm, or if he's young, actually sitting the child in their lap. Then the parent tells the child exactly what he did wrong and how the parent feels about it, and in no uncertain terms. Finally, the parent takes a deep breath and allows for a few seconds of silence, so the child can feel whatever the parent's feeling. And then the parent tells the youngster how valuable and important the child is to the parent. You see, it's very important when you're managing people to remember that behavior and worth are not the same thing. What is really worthwhile is the person managing their own behavior. That is as true of each of us as managers as it is of each of the people we are managing. In fact, if you know this, the manager said as he pointed to one of his favorite plaques, you will know the key to a really successful reprimand. We are not just our behavior. We are the person managing our behavior. If you realize that you are managing people and not just their recent behavior, you will do well. Sounds like there's a lot of caring and respect behind such a reprimand. I'm glad you noticed that, young man. You'll be successful with the one-minute reprimand when you really care about the welfare of the person you're reprimanding. That reminds me. Mr. Levy told me that you pat him on the shoulder or shake hands or in some other way make contact with him during appraising. And now I notice that the parents are encouraged to touch their children during the scolding. Is touching an important part of the one-minute praisings and reprimands? Yes and no, the manager answered with a smile. Yes, if you know the person well and are clearly interested in helping the person to succeed in his or her work, and no, if you or the other person has any doubts about that. Touch is a very powerful message. People have strong feelings about being touched, and that needs to be respected. Touch is very honest. People know immediately when you touch them whether you care about them or whether you're just trying to find a way to manipulate them. There's a very simple rule about touching. When you touch, don't take. Touch the people you manage only when you're giving them something. Reassurance, support, encouragement, whatever. So you should refrain from touching someone until you know them and they know that you're interested in their success, that you are clearly on their side. But while the one-minute praisings and the one-minute reprimands look simple enough, aren't they really just powerful ways for you to get people to do what you want them to do? And isn't that manipulative?
You're right about one-minute management being a powerful way to get people to do what you want them to do. However, manipulation is getting people to do something they are either not aware of or don't agree to. That is why it's so important to let each person know up front what you're doing and why. It's like anything else in life. There are things that work and things that don't work. Being honest with people eventually works. On the other hand, as you've probably learned in your own life, being dishonest eventually leads to failing with people. It's just that simple. I can see now where the power of your management style comes from. You care about people. Yeah. Yeah, I guess I do. The young man remembered how gruff he thought this special manager was when he first met him. It was as though the manager could read his mind. Sometimes, the one-minute manager said, you have to care enough to be tough, and I am. I'm very tough on the poor performance, but only on the performance. I'm never tough on the person. The young man liked the one-minute manager. He knew now why people liked to work with him. Maybe you would find this interesting, sir. It's a plaque I've created to remind me of how goals, the one-minute goals, the consequences, the praisings and the reprimands, affect people's behavior. The plaque read, goals begin behaviors, consequences maintain behaviors. That's very good, the manager exclaimed. Do you think so? The young man asked, wanting to hear the compliment once again. Young man, it is not my role in life to be a human tape recorder. I do not have time to continually repeat myself. Just when he thought he would be praised, the young man felt he was in for another one-minute reprimand, something he wanted to avoid. The bright young man kept a straight face and said simply, what? They each looked at each other only for a moment, and then they burst into laughter. I like you, young man. How would you like to go to work here? The young man put down his notebook and stared in amazement. You mean go to work for you? No, I mean go to work for yourself, like the other people in my department. Nobody ever really works for anybody else. I just help people work better, and in the process, they benefit our organization. This was, of course, what the young man had been looking for all along. I'd love to work here. And so he did, for some time. The time the special manager had invested in him paid off, because eventually, the inevitable happened. He became a one-minute manager, not because he thought like one or talked like one, but because he behaved like one. He set one-minute goals, he gave one-minute praisings, he gave one-minute reprimands, he asked brief, important questions, spoke the simple truth, laughed, worked, and enjoyed. And perhaps most important of all, he encouraged the people he worked with to do the same.
We invite you to send us your comments on this program, and we'd like to send you the latest free edition of our cassette catalog. Just write to us at the address on the label of this cassette.